Good morning.
We're off to a bit of a slow start. I'm Nathaniel from the Film Experience, and I have Joe Reed.
Hi.
And Katie Rich.
Good morning.
And we're waiting for Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks, and he's having a little bit of computer trouble, but we'll be joining us shortly.
If all computer golf.
Shuttling back in from Elysium.
Yeah. Maybe we're on Elysium, and he's trying to get to us.
You know, Elysium is only a week old, and I find that it feels like it came out ages ago, and nobody cares about it already.
Yeah,
I feel like a lot of the summer blockbusters felt that way. Like, I forget even what I was doing the weekend that Pacific Rim came out, but I couldn't see it that opening weekend. And by the time I was back to scanning the listings, I was like, wow, Pacific Rim was like, came and went so incredibly thoroughly.
Do you remember how there was a Star Trek movie this summer?
Right?
I tend to forget that.
No, you mean in February. That was summer.
That's true. I tend to get very nostalgic and sad when summer starts to end, but then I realize, like, Iron Man 3 was this summer and not 2 years ago. It's crazy.
Yeah. It's true. That's even the ones that I pretty much liked, like Iron Man 3, I was just like, wow, that's just a different year entirely, it feels like.
We were different people then.
I think that happens with the Oscar movies, too, actually.
Yeah.
They all come out at once, and then you're just, like, done with your big message movie dramas.
Yeah. Actually, can we quickly talk about something Oscar-y related to that? The Foxcatcher news.
What an odd detour for this podcast.
I know. Bear with me, though. The news that Sony Pictures Classics is going to distribute Foxcatcher and open it December 20th.
Yes.
Which is, as we know, sort of in that no man's land of end of the year. Is it a good idea? Is it not? It's always, because I feel like we tend to rumble about end of year stuff just because it makes it so inconvenient for all of us. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it does turn out to be a good thing. Million Dollar Baby, I think, still doesn't win the Best Picture Oscar if it doesn't come out at the very end of the year like it
did. Well, I mean, that's true of a lot of, I mean, that I think that is the reason
that
they do it, is because A, box office, because you can capitalize on the Oscar nominations if you do the later rollouts,
mm-hmm.
and B, you can control the conversation a lot better, and they're all about controlling the conversation, and if everybody is convinced that you are the top dog before anybody has the opportunity to see you, you can ride on that for quite a long time.
Although but for this particular movie, do we think it's a good idea?
It's funny to me that it's not coming with festival plans, at least so far. I was kind of expecting it to be on the TIFF lineup, and it still might be a New York Film Festival or something like that. But I was thinking about Amore, which Classics had last year, opened really late. I think it opened like December 31st. But so many people had seen it and talked about it by the time that happened. So it'd be stranger if it was a small movie with, like, you know, an interesting cast, but not crazy heavyweight holiday season stuff, and then also opening that late. So maybe we have to figure out what festival it'll be at first.
Right. Well, and I thought of last time Sony Pictures Classics and Bennett Miller were together on something, which was Capote, as I recall. That was Classics, yes?
I think so.
Yes.
And that opened in, like, October, right?
Capote opened September 30th, apparently.
Yeah.
But Moneyball also had a little bit of an advance before, you know, the glut of all the movies.
Oh, right. Yes. That was a bigger movie in general. I just think there's a real danger that Foxcatcher gets sort of swallowed up. And that's going to be a bummer for me because I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, that's really high on your list, isn't it?
Like, I'm very intrigued about the Steve Carell thing. And Lord knows I like Mark Ruffalo and Channing Tatum.
Well,
and
the story sounds very interesting, too.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi, Nick's
Hello.
Back.
Nick is joining us. We are discussing
Foxcatcher?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
We were discussing the news that it had been added to the December lineup. And I'm still waiting for something to be dropped from the December lineup and moved to 2014, because we know that news is coming, too. We just don't know which movie it is.
Yeah.
Well, Joe was threatening me yesterday that it's The Immigrant.
Oh.
I haven't heard anything about it, right?
Wasn't it at Cannes in some capacity?
It was in competition,
but
I haven't been promoting it since.
I do find it odd that Grace of Monaco is supposed to open before Christmas for Thanksgiving, and we still haven't seen a trailer or anything.
Right.
Isn't that true, that Diana movie also, which I would be fine if it burned in the lab, but
that has a trailer.
Yeah, but it doesn't have an American release date.
there is a lot of room for movement still. But then it is only August. Nick, we were discussing that Elysium, even though it's only a week old, everybody seems to be over it. But I don't know, does anybody have anything to say about it? Or do you feel like it's not, the fast fade is because there isn't a lot to say about it?
What I would like to hear from you guys, the talk about Jodie Foster's performance has been so strange, and people seem to be really against it, and it's weird to me that Jodie Foster would be so polarizing, so I'm really curious about what happened with that.
She is weirdly horrendous. Like it's a bad... Like, the accent is at the sort of Kevin Costner, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves place of, like, I don't know what this is.
Isn't she supposed to be French?
Unclear.
Well, yeah, and it's unclear, which is spectacularly odd given that she is very fluent in French.
Yeah,
and she does speak some French at different times while she's up there, and she looks a lot like that French woman who's the head of the IMF for the World Bank, like, is clearly who she's been styled as. Mm. But she kind of sounds like, I have no idea what she's doing.
I thought it was South African for a minute.
It sounded like that sometimes.
Was she just trying to be all countries for all of us to represent every politician?
One-woman IMF.
There is that way in which, like, you know, the movie is trying to show us that everybody has, like, kind of Spanish and Portuguese last names now, but they kind of look pretty light-skinned. Like, it could be, like, one world, you know, whatever. So maybe she's, like, one world of villainy. But she just plays it like she's the villain in Spy Kids or something. She's so crazily broad.
Yeah. If you had asked me in the 90s, I was just thinking about that the other day, like, but if you had asked in the 90s who would really still have it together later on, you would not necessarily think that Angelina Jolie and Robert Downey Jr. were going to be, like, so in charge of their worlds.
In our worlds,
and Jodie Foster would be, like, off the rails. She just seems so odd lately.
Are you thinking about her Golden Globe speech?
And then this, and then the acting being so much less than it used to be. It's just very...
I think part of it is that she acts so rarely that you would think that the choices she makes would be better.
And she says so often how Nell is her favorite of her own performances because she finally wasn't so worried about precision and being in control and whatever. So it does seem like, I get it, that she's trying to play against what she thinks is her
wheelhouse,
but it's distractingly awful. And Charlton Copley's pretty aggressively awful in it too, but in a way that he's kind of having way too much fun.
Uh-huh.
And you couldn't say that about her.
Right.
Sometimes when I see a performance that seems so incredibly, unbelievably terrible, I start to wonder how much responsibility falls on the director. I sort of always think of The Happening. Did anybody else see that Shyamalan movie, The Happening?
Oh, yes.
And Mark Wahlberg and Zooey Deschanel are so terrible in it, but to the point where I started to be like, okay, well, they think they're in a movie that they're not in. And that's ultimately on M. Night Shyamalan.
I watched a Gloria Graham movie this week. In. Not the one that's up for the supporting actress SmackDown next week, but a different one. And I read that she tried so hard to be so horrible in it because she thought her character was gratuitous and she was hoping she could just be cut because she hated the movie. So
which movie was this?
Is bad in every scene, but it's called Macau. Uh-huh. It's a Joseph von Sternberg movie 20 years after his heyday, and I thought that was just a funny approach to one's working life.
A terrible performance as activism.
Maybe Jodie saw the rushes of Charlton, and she's like, that's more than enough villainy for one movie.
Well, Elysium.
Yeah.
So that's what there is to say about Elysium, huh?
Well, right? The main problem, I would say, is that it just, like, the characters are just so uninvolving, and do you remember any personality for any of the characters other than that the performances weren't good, you know?
Oh, Elysium?
Yeah. It's like, even with sci-fi and message movies, like, if you don't have anybody that you can latch onto as a recognizable human that you're interested in, like, what is there to be interested in?
I would totally agree with that, and yet my mind was in the totally different place of, like, like, in the same way that District 9 starts as a found footage movie and then halfway through just forgets that, like,
right.
This is, like, so crazy disheveled that I was just having a blast, trying not to laugh because maybe people in the theater were liking it, but, like, there's the scene you've seen in the trailer where Matt Damon has now been outfitted with, like, a super cyborg exoskeleton.
Right.
He's hanging out with his ex-girlfriend for a while and then leaves and gets beat the fuck up by a bunch of robots and then shows back up on her doorstep. And, you know, the last time she saw him, he was like a normal human person. And this time he's on the sidewalk and she goes, "Oh my God, you're bleeding. You've been stabbed." And there's like a little 1-inch stab wound on his abdomen, but there's a huge, giant metal exoskeleton that he used to have. And they have a 10-minute scene and she never mentions it, which is amazing. I was in the Prometheus place of like, this doesn't make one lick of sense. This is hilarious. It was as good at that time when Jennifer Connelly doesn't even know yet that Eric Bana has been turned into the Hulk, but wakes up that one night and her cabin is shaking. She goes, "Bruce?" Like, how does she know? It was that kind of movie.
Wow, I was not expecting a Connelly Bana.
No,
well, I was intimidated by Joe's,
Hulk.
Joe's drop of Bruno Kirby last time set the bar. So. But Katie wants to talk about The Butler, so we should get to
yes,
it.
Yes, we should.
She loved it.
I feel like there's so much to chew over in The Butler.
I do too, actually.
Yeah. And Katie, you are not alone.
And then we drop out. We're like, yes, there's so much to talk about. And then there's this moment of...
And then silence for 20 minutes.
Nick,
we're all thinking about it.
I know. Oprah's staring us down.
You know,
I
feel like there is so many different movies happening within that movie that I almost don't care if it's good or not, because I just enjoyed, like, watching each of the separate movies, and, you know, I don't know if anybody else felt that way. It was just all over the place for me, quality-wise.
It's well, all over
Lee
the place.
Lee Daniels hallmark at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead, Joe.
It's all over the place in terms of, you know, it's sort of episodic and, and tones shift. I didn't mind the shifting tones as much because I always really liked that kind of trashiness whenever they went back to his home. Trashiness for him is almost like verisimilitude, where it's just sort of like this is how he brings reality into a story that feels so much like a fable at times. And so that I really liked. I thought the stuff with the presidents does seem very obviously episodic. And none of those performances is actually any good, but I feel like they're all just sort of this like traveling carnival sideshow of living wax figures. So it's like, whatever. I feel like the movie doesn't really hinge so much upon the acting, for me, doesn't hinge on that movie. The thing that I really like the best about the movie is just sort of the way it wrestles with the idea of itself. The idea of this Butler character who is present for history but not active in history, and how really a lesser movie would have made that like a Forrest Gump kind of thing, where it's just like, oh, look at the, you know, look at how fantastic it was that he was there for all this history. And
yeah,
this movie is smart enough to be really ambivalent about it and to sort of critique that idea kind of at every step of the way.
I was worried at first that it was taking a very sort of strong stance against sort of political activism in the way that Forrest Gump does, actually.
Right.
Because the scenes with the Black Panthers and the sort of more all the scenes involving the son, there's moments where you feel like it's really judging how sort of rebellious they are and how far they're pushing things. But then I find that it also course corrected a lot there, so that you saw that there were different ways of being political, or different, you know, just ways of living life in the center of all the politics. So I did like that it had some reversals there, and you sort of could accept that both men, both the father and the son, you know, that might, that could be the right choice for them, for their personality.
Right.
even though they were such different choices. So I thought that that central drama was actually fairly well handled.
I mean, those are actually really interesting opinions to hear. So it's just like, I like talking to you guys because that makes me rethink a little bit. But I'm Team Katie on this in general. And I don't know. Like, I think some of those scenes were so broad for a while that even though the course correction is interesting, and what I realized at the end of the movie, the two things I was curious about were actually all the, it's not fair to say the least political stuff, but like I thought there was a father-son drama that was pretty compelling, kind of waiting to get more expression in there, and there's also like a pretty cool marriage story in there that would be really well handled by a movie that, like, you know, there's that scene where Oprah's like, I don't just like sit at home and do nothing. It's like, well, actually you do.
According to this movie.
Do nothing. Like, yeah. Sometimes you dance in front of the mirror, which is great, but it just felt like beyond the acting of the presidents not being super compelling, or Joe, did you just say it just felt like a distraction sometimes, or I forget how you put it. And the only thing I really liked about them was that they seemed so ridiculous that there was a way of seeing kind of, you know, normative white power as absurd in a way, like the White House seemed like rotating cast of characters. But otherwise, I just felt like we need to get out of the White House and out of the workspace as quickly as possible. Like, it's killing everything I like in the movie. And I didn't think the points it was making were kind of strong enough to compensate for half of a film that just didn't work for me.
Yeah, it makes you wonder why this movie had to be about a guy who works in the White House and not just a guy who works as a butler for anywhere else and be about the conflict that he has with his family as a result of it. It feels like it trivializes both ends of it, like you were talking about the distraction of the presidents. And then also just the idea of, like, seeing, you know, the civil rights movement, like seeing Lyndon Johnson decide to do the Great Society through having one conversation with this guy who works in his office, and that happens over and over again. I mean, it's not as strongly implied as like Forrest Gump changed history, but it's definitely there and way less interesting, like we've been saying, than the family drama that had so much nuance to it. And I mean, I think I'm a big fan of David Oyelowo at this point, and I feel like he could have his entire own movie about the Freedom Riders and the Black Panthers, and that movie could be directed by Lee Daniels with like all of his excess, and it could be really good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I loved all the stuff with the family, actually, which has sort of carried me through the movie, so I feel like even if we're all sort of all over the place on quality, I think that part of it, I think everyone agrees, is the strongest part. Like, I personally loved every scene with Oprah. I thought she was so much fun to watch, and one of the things I like about his movies for all of their messiness is how spontaneous all the acting always feels in his movies. Like, in my review, I was saying that at once it feels like this performance done by a complete professional who understands, like, you know, every bit of how she can play with the audience. And on the other hand, it's so uninhibited, it feels like she doesn't know the camera's on and she's a novice, you know?
Hmm. Yeah. My big worry going in was that it would be Oprah trying very, very hard to play against type, and we would sort of see the strain on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't the case. I felt like she eased into that a lot more calmly, I think, than I was expecting. And it's still, I mean, there's no way to get around that it's still jarring for the audience member to see Oprah Winfrey acting this trashy after, you know, all these years of sort of her projecting this one image on television. But I feel like we get there, and I feel like we get there without a whole lot of, like, jostling. And by the end, she's just this woman who's a little, you know, a little trashy at heart, little whatever, but, like, ultimately, she's a lady. She's just a lady of her times.
I just felt so frustrated every time she was on screen. Like, I agree that she's interesting, but like the fact that character just literally never went anywhere. She was just inside the house all the time, doing almost nothing. She's got this flirtation with Terrence Howard that's pretty purposeless. Like, I couldn't really see any. I mean, it gives her, you know, some weird flirtation with Terrence Howard on a couch, and that's something you don't expect to see Oprah doing, but doesn't really add that much to the story of her marriage. It was kind of just kind of brushed over. Mm. And when, yeah, I wanted to see more from what she was doing. And then you get the moments where she's kind of adding this weird levity, like when Kennedy is shot and he comes home. And I think her line is literally, "I'm real sorry about the president, but you and that White House can kiss my ass." And it's such a weird yeah. tone to strike about, you know, something that's like very jarring within the context of the movie. It's just, it felt like she was in this really kind of interesting, earthy, not so serious historical story. And then all these presidents kept getting in the way.
Well, the presidents yeah, somebody, do get in the way.
Somebody in the Color Purple feature that you just did was I think it was Pretentious Know It All, but that might be wrong, was saying how his admiration for her performance in Color Purple kind of diminished once he realized how the movie rarely asks her to act with anybody, that she just seems like she's kind of in parallel. Even when she's sharing a scene, mm-hmm. you don't always feel such a strong connection with who she's with in the film. And I did feel that way here, too. I mean, I liked her in it, more or less, and I did think she got saddled with really weird scenes, like that one that Katie just mentioned, or the one where she's
like,
having
throw
to explain.
Down, that's my favorite movie, and that's my favorite scene in the movie. But I'll explain in a minute.
Okay.
Oh, all right. Well, then I'm going to take 10 more seconds. Or the crazy woman has to explain to her family who Emmett Till was, and just run down the bullet points of that whole situation, which was insane to have to tell any African American family 2 years later who Emmett Till was and what happened to him. Like, not a good first scene, but. I just felt like we kept going back to those family scenes and I had lost track of who she was supposed to be or what the marriage was like or what they were going through because I had missed all the connecting material and something's changed and Gloria does something during the day, but I couldn't guess what. Mm-hmm.
Well, my favorite scene in the movie is the scene that you guys do not like. And because I loved Oprah in the movie, and B, I love scenes that initially feel like they're taking place in a totally different movie if in retrospect they feel like the movie to me, and because I feel like they're keys to sort of unlocking the crazy, you know. And I love that I love when he's spinning the hangers.
That her line in that scene is one of her best moments, I think.
Yeah, and then he's talking about, like, sort of their parallel worlds. And I thought that's really true of what the movie is doing with the entire family unit. And with Cecil at his job, is that there are all these people living in, you know, ostensibly the same, sharing the same air and living in the same space, but they have completely different worlds. And that's true of the father and the son, that's true of, especially true of the butler with the whole half of the movie that's about the workplace, where he's valued for not being in the room even when he's in the room. And so I thought it was like a really interesting way to, it was one of the least sort of underlined ways that they pointed out this problem of connection and people living completely separate lives within the same space.
Well, and I think that's where the Terrence Howard character starts to make sense, is that at his workplace, Forrest Whitaker is very trained to, as you said, be in the room without being in the room. And the more he starts to take that home, that contrast with somebody like Terrence Howard, who takes up all of the room whenever he's there, like, that to me made some sense. And that to me... Mm-hmm.
You guys are making this movie sound interesting in retrospect. I feel like that's a superpower that Lee Daniels... Like, I've had the feeling about The Paperboy, too. Like, I hear people talking about it. I'm like, oh, maybe I owe The Paperboy another look. And then I kind of think more about it. I'm like, oh, wait, no, that would be painful to watch.
Yeah, see, I was on your side of the fence with that one, for sure.
But now I've been, like, tempted to watch it again, just thinking about it. Well, like, thinking about all the craziest moments of this and how that's what's interesting. And, like, Lee Daniels' wheelhouse is obviously in that kind of big stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually why I'm less interested in whether or not people think his movies are good than if they're actually, like, processing them.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, Precious and The Paperboy and this one, I think, you know, there are a ton of movies that are well-made but are instantly forgettable. And his movies, like, even if you want to argue until you're blue that they're badly made, they are not forgettable. they are totally interesting to me, at least.
I totally agree, and I'll be happy every time a new one comes out for that reason. But part of what disappointed me about this one was that it did actually feel kind of conservative in that way. Like some of the cues about how to feel about the characters or what was absolutely going to happen 45 seconds from now all felt really in place in a way that, I mean, not to pigeonhole him into making one kind of movie, because if he wants to you know, experiment with a more conventional style, that's cool, but I kind of missed the vulgarity and the schizophrenia that I think he works with in really interesting ways, and instead was getting, like, you know, there's an important character whose death is major news to the other characters in the family at one point. Mm-hmm. And 2 minutes away from that, even though it's clearly structured as a scene where, like, the tone of the scene's going to be way up here and have to, you know, collapse into the basement at a moment's notice, like, there's just no question it's what's happening, right? And there were... I thought there were just way too many scenes like that, where if there's anything to say about a Lee Daniels scene, it's that you don't know where the beats are or what's going to happen, and I rarely felt that in this.
Here's a bit of an open-ended question, though. I'm going to make the cardinal lawyer mistake and ask a question without knowing the answer. is there a way at this point to do any kind of historical movie making and make the history seem spontaneous in the moment, in that we've seen movies about history so much that we know, we're so attuned to the beats, we're so attuned to anytime anybody mentions the word Dallas... that Kennedy is about to get assassinated. We're so you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there's no possible way that we won't be sort of over foreshadowed for things like that. And I wonder, I'm trying to think of the last time I saw something historical that seemed truly surprising.
Well, see, that's why I like that's why I like, conceptually at least, when stories like this take your point of view being a character that you know nothing about, that's not a famous character. Because I think that affords you all sorts of opportunities to make it feel a little more lived in, like, as history is actually lived. But then it didn't... I totally agree that in terms of, like, a historical epic, it's just as boring as all the other ones in terms of, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened.
Right, because this is a character who's, you know, this is a person whose story is being told because we haven't heard it. And yet, as Nick says, like, there's just no getting around... that we see things coming down the pipe.
So many of the signposts. Although there is one really interesting scene talking about Kennedy being shot that, like, felt like the most Lee Daniels this history got, is when basically he comes into the room and Jackie Kennedy's sitting there. Jackie Kennedy, played by a silent Minka Kelly.
Minka Kelly, I know.
She has no lines, I think.
Neither Minka Kelly nor Mariah Carey spoke at all. So,
but Minka Kelly's sitting there in the pink suit with the blood on it, and there's, like, a tight close-up on the blood, and it's, like, this very visceral bit of history. And I don't know if it's in good taste. I don't know. I mean, it didn't fit in with, you know, whatever else was going on, but at least... stuck out, and it was at least kind of a way to see the Kennedy assassination in a way that I had not seen on screen before.
That's a great point.
Yeah, and there was just, but then you go back and you have, you know, Lyndon Johnson, like, running around being like, what about this civil rights?
I was going to say, it wasn't as much the historical events inevitability that bothered me. It was that, and I, my answer to Joe's question would be that one way to solve that problem is to put us with characters like these, because I have no idea how this household's going to react to Kennedy's assassination, or what the rest of the service staff in the White House is also a pretty cool enclave in the movie.
Yeah,
but it was the inevitability of the dramatic beats among those characters.
I see.
That, like, that the fact that they were so, you know, even what's, you know, Oprah's last scene is clearly Oprah's last scene from the second it starts, if not from the previous scene. Like, their own...
Yeah.
Their own beats felt so spelled out, which was exactly where I thought the movie would find room to kind of stretch and surprise us, and it seemed less and less eager to do that.
Mm-hmm. I do wanna say a quick thank you to whatever deity we might be thanking. That A, I got to see Oprah Winfrey and Forrest Whitaker in matching tracksuits. and then I got to hear her call Yaya DaCosta a low-class trifling bitch. much at some point before. And I love Yaya back to the holidays.
Can I just say that I'm so happy that she's getting work, Yaya DaCosta?
I'm so proud of her every time I see her on screen. I'm just like, you should have won your season. And you're making up for it now, and that's fine.
I also want to credit the perfect casting of Alex Pettifer as a creepy... not an overseer. I don't know what you would call the guy. But that guy has always seemed like a worm, and that is his best casting yet.
Oh,
He's always most effective when people cast him for his thoroughly unlikable face. And I But can we all agree that...
Yeah, is there a greater disconnect between personal beauty and, and like, sort of wanting to look at the face? I'm like, I hate him every time I see him.
Right, right. Yeah. But we can all agree that Vanessa Redgrave should never attempt another Southern accent for the rest of her life.
Oh, my God. That's what that was? It was Southern.
I actually thought it was going to be the worst movie of the year in that whole sequence. Like, Mariah Carey, Vanessa Redgrave, everything. I was like, why is this movie happening to me? But then
I just don't understand why you, like, go so far as to give me a giant gift by having Vanessa Redgrave and Mariah Carey in the same movie, and then they can't just have one scene together? Like, can they have one?
That is the shot mashup that the world has been waiting for, Mariah Carey v. Vanessa Redgrave.
That's Nick's personal
Mariah Carey best. And Vanessa Redgrave in Night Mother.
That's Nick's personal Bechdel test. If Mariah Carey and Vanessa Redgrave are in a movie and talk to each other about anything besides a man, it is a successful movie.
Right.
This movie does not exist, but we...
Yet.
So what do we think of its Oscar prospects?
I want to hear you, Nathaniel, the Oprah fan, argue for her winning this supporting actress, because I thought she was fine, but the entire movie did not sit well enough with me for me to think that it would go anywhere. And then it started getting great reviews, and now I don't know which way is up, so...
Well, I mean, regardless of how much I enjoyed the performance, we have seen so little of the potential players that I would hardly want to call it my favorite or anything. But I do think that given her stature, I mean, you know, I was arguing about this on Twitter recently, but given that they would give her an honorary, which I understand is for her humanitarian work, but she's not really that much a part of the film industry. So I really didn't understand the purpose of that. Given that they love her enough to do that, I can't see how she's not a threat to win.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a very interesting campaign.
Because it just seems like it's too... She's obviously like a star that's on a level where people just have the star worship problem. That it's really hard to view them as apart from...
Yeah.
How fabulous and large they loom, you know?
Mm-hmm. But I bet you she gets pushback from... Like, obviously she has a billion famous friends.
Yeah.
But I bet you there is an undercurrent of resentment that might rear its head if she's in position to win an acting award.
Because she's Oprah and she already has everything?
Yeah, not necessarily among actors, but sort of like... I bet there is some kind of a streak of like, oh, doesn't she have enough?
Well, I mean, I feel that way even myself. Like when I was arguing with Guy Lodge on Twitter recently about her, I hadn't seen the movie yet, but I was just pissed that, oh, now she's going to get a second Oscar, even though she's not really a film person, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I was even resentful of it before seeing it, and I'm still sort of resentful of the notion that so many of the best actors of all time never have trophies and she might end up with two, even though I liked her in the movie. So yeah, I do agree that she'll get pushback, but I just don't...
But we all know honorary Oscars don't count.
The point is that there will be two Oscar statues as bookends.
I think overall the movie is... And I sort of, when I saw it, I was still, when I first saw it at the screening, I was kind of bereft as to how to take it in terms of its chances.
Mm-hmm.
But now that the mainstream critics seem to have largely gone for it, and it is going, it's going to be a certain financial success,
mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be a real threat to be on the Best Picture list, particularly now because we've still got the expanded list.
Mm-hmm.
And then Forest Whitaker and Oprah and makeup and costumes. By God, the costumes.
Oh my God, tracksuits.
So I think certainly it's in play for all of those. If Oprah's disco outfit and wig is not paraded across the stage by some Debbie Allen dancer, I'm so disappointed.
Katie, I was at a little going away party for Chris Tapley,
mm-hmm.
And I was talking to Matt Patches about The Butler because I had just seen it, and I think it was him. But I was talking to a group, but I think it was him. It was actually complaining about those track suits that Joe loves so much. It's just like, why are you making a joke at this point in the movie with
yeah.
these track suits?
It's incredibly distracting.
So I don't know about the craft categories. Like, I don't think it looks very good.
You and Joe are a team right now, and you really shouldn't sort of, you know, go against your teammate in a situation like this. Like, this is...
Wait, what team are we on?
We're Team Butler.
Yeah,
I'm not really that... Like, I enjoyed watching it a lot, but...
Oh, see, he's abandoning me. Look at this.
I think you don't understand the internet. You are either for or against it. And we all decided, because you said a nice adjective at one point, that you're for it. So hold to that.
Oh,
am I allowed to say I didn't think Forrest Whitaker was very good in this movie, and like that nomination will annoy me even more than Oprah's if it happens? Like,
I just didn't get it.
I don't think he'll be nominated personally. It's such a cipher role, and though it is the Forrest Gump role in Forrest Gump, in a way, it is also doesn't have any showy parts.
It was sort of a reminder that before Last King of Scotland, I'm not sure I'd ever seen the great actor in Forrest Whitaker. Like, you'd have to go back to, like, small parts in The Color of Money and I have not seen Bird, I should say that, but he'd never made a lot of sense to me on screen, and now I kind of think of him in a different way because of Scotland, but I mean, it seems so awful to say it like this, but it just felt like, oh, I forgot that I didn't like you that much as an actor, that you sometimes seem like you should be doing a little bit more. I mean, it just reminded me of him in The Crying Game, or like times where I think he's in really interesting scenes where a lot could happen, and I didn't think the story structure was helping him here, because you see how he's trying to give Cecil a sexuality at home and be really kind of excited to see his wife, and is sort of frisky sometimes and is trying to play against just like blank, sexless, invisible cipher. But mm-hmm. I just didn't get from scene to scene how he was connecting the stuff he was trying to do. And his epiphany's way too broad at the end. Like, there's no way you've never thought about this before, but your face is showing me, oh my God, I'd never consider, like, whatever. Okay.
You're against the movie and everything in it.
I am against it. I am biased.
I think he's actually against civil rights. That's what it means not to like The Butler.
That's right.
That's what bugs me about the idea of, I mean...
I'm sure that's what people are saying on the internet. I'm not going to name names, but...
Yeah.
Like, this movie can have its Oscar buzz. I think it just bugs me that, like, when you make a movie about life in the White House and there's a bunch of famous people playing presidents, like, you will get Oscar buzz. It's just, like, a guarantee, like, regardless of how much that important history actually benefits the film.
I don't know, though, because I feel like... I think there was a definite path to disaster here that... It could have, like, I think it's getting the Oscar buzz that it's getting, both because of the type of movie it is, because it's a spectacle, but also because, like, a lot of major critics really did like it. And I feel like if the conversation would be completely different if it really bombed out in that respect. Mm-hmm. And
my audience clearly loved it.
Oh, yeah, my audience did too, yeah.
Behar and Alec Baldwin really loved it.
Sherry Shepherd was in my audience.
Was she? Oh, funny. So we've got already.
Wait.
We've almost got view bingo.
Wow. You guys are like bragging. I just saw it with civilians.
Oh, how dare you. Yeah. It was, I walked past her on the way into the screening room, and I was just like, I kind of like panicked for a second because Sherry Shepherd's amazing. And I kind of thought she was in it. Maybe she's in the movie. And I said, didn't know that. And then she wasn't in it, which is a bummer. I couldn't
she's
make
in
her
it play. As Angie Jordan at the very end.
You guys, in my crowd, it was very packed, and there was audible tears and a uh-huh. lot of laughter. But there was this woman right in front of me who I think she hadn't been to a movie in a really long time. You know the type when you're at a movie. Because
I love that type.
Because every single trailer, she was like, at the end of, no matter what the trailer was, and it, there was really schizophrenic trailers playing before it, she would be like, or, well, or, that looks so interesting, like every single movie, even though they were like completely, for completely different audiences, she was fascinated by every trailer.
The woman next to me in the critic screening, anytime anyone used the N-word, would gasp. Like, I can't believe this movie was so horrible. Like, really? I felt like she just, like, missed her, like, 60s history lesson or something.
My audience progressively got less and less reverent about the presidential depictions, where by the time we got to Ellen Rickman and Jane Fonda, Jane Fonda as Nancy Reagan probably elicited the laughter that I'm thinking Lee Daniels intended.
Yeah, I mean, it's very SNL sketch, some of those presidential
things. For as much as we've seen every iteration of John F. Kennedy impersonation, I thought James Marsden did a pretty okay job with it.
Yeah, he was a little too good to fit. He was a little disruptive because he wasn't...
He was distractingly not terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, say what you will about John Cusack's Nixon, but it is not like any other Nixon we've seen.
My favorite thing in The Butler now is Katie's interview with Lee Daniels, where they belabor John Cusack's intense preparation and, like, all the subtlety he wanted to bring to it, like the subtle sweat and the subtle... He actually says in the interview, if you know me, you know I'm into the subtle.
And one never thinks of subtle when one thinks of John Cusack.
Or Lee Daniels, for
well,
that
or Lee Daniels.
Like, let's cover all those bases.
Or Nixon. Yeah, right.
I mean, if those two teamed up and made a Nixon biopic, we would all be there in a heartbeat.
For one reason or another, yes.
For the sweat. All about the sweat.
Yeah, and that reason would be the other reason. Okay.
And
so,
because Pat Nixon would be played by Misha Barton.
Oh, so thanks for joining us to talk Elysium and The Butler, but mostly The Butler. As we sign off, I want you to tell me which actor you wish you had seen shoehorned into this eclectic cast in The Butler.
Okay.
So, Joe?
Oh, God. Okay. Bye. This is Joe Reed. I really wish I had seen Beyonce in this movie.
With short or long hair?
Oh, God. With all of the afro that that Oprah was not wearing.
Or that Yaya got.
My God, Beyonce versus Yaya in a Black Panther standoff is all I want. Beyonce as Angela Davis. Go!
Katie?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm just going to stick with Sherry Shepherd just because I got in my head that she was in it, and I was disappointed when she wasn't. And Joe's idea that she shows up as Angie Jordan at the end of it is, that sounds great to me.
Devon told me she's the new spokeswoman for the Ham Council.
People do like the way she says ham.
Ham!
And Nick?
I'm Nick from Nick's Flick Picks, and... I don't know. I think I want to see Jimmy Smits give the Gerald Ford he's had in him for a long time. Maybe just have this movie be turn into a Cloud Atlas where everybody awkwardly passed as everybody else, and Forrest Whitaker could have been all the presidents.
I'm sure Forrest Whitaker's Jimmy Carter would have been game-changing.
Wow.
And Oprah's Eisenhower would have been the bomb.
I wish I could have seen Tilda Swinton.
Oh,
as the White House?
As Pat Nixon, as the White House.